You are listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from the unceded Coast Salish territories of the Musqueam people. March 25th, animal welfare scientist Temple Grandin gave a talk in the Alumni Center entitled Maintaining High Standards in Animal Welfare. Temple Grandin is widely considered one of the world's top animal welfare scientists. In North America, almost half of the cattle are handled in a system that she designed. She is a champion of animal welfare and also happens to be autistic. Dr. Grandin got her start in the cattle industry during the early 70s, a time when being a woman in a man's industry was very difficult. For this reason and many others, we thought that Temple Grandin would be an apt addition to our International Women's Day broadcast. To learn more about Temple Grandin or to see her systems, you can visit www.grandin.com.
It gives me great pleasure to introduce you to our host for the evening, Dr. David Fraser, professor and program director of our Applied Biology program and one of the founders of our Animal Welfare program. David?
Thank you, Ricky. On behalf of all of us in the Animal Welfare Program, it is a real delight to be hosting the event tonight and a great pleasure to have you all with us. Tonight is sponsored by two organizations. One is the Animal Welfare Foundation of Canada, which, among its other good works, has very kindly sponsored an annual event here at UBC to focus public attention on animal welfare issues and the use of science to find solutions. One of our graduates, who we are very proud of, is Leanne McConaughey, who is a trustee of the foundation. I would invite you to speak to Leanne during the reception, find out about the work of the foundation and how you could become involved. We are also very happy to partner with Alumni UBC, the Alumni Association of the University, who kindly included this event as one of their centennial sessions for the faculty. And we have Kaylee Ann McNabb, who is, there we are in the far corner. She is our staff person liaising with Alumni UBC, and I invite you, especially alumni, to speak to her downstairs afterwards during the reception. She will tell you all about our newsletter, the Reach Out magazine. She'll sign you up for an alumni card and tell you about our event on June 25th at the UBC farm. And I also want to thank Urban Digs, a local farm and food producer who have provided some of the food that will be available in the reception. All right. In introducing my old friend and colleague Temple Grandin, I'm sort of torn between two temptations. One temptation is to list her many accomplishments in improving animal welfare, from designing low-stress handling facilities to developing animal welfare audits that are used around the world. But if I did that, it would take too long. The other temptation is to say that for a group like this, coming to a talk on animal welfare, the one person who needs no introduction is the one who was, in 2010, on Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People list, about whom HBO made a biographical film that won 7 Emmys. But if I took that option, it would be too short. So I've decided on a third route, which is simply to give a personal comment. UBC has one of relatively few programs, academic programs in the world devoted to animal welfare, improving the lives of animals. And because it is rare and has become well known, we have people come from all continents and many different walks of life who want to come either as graduate students or just to be part of our activities. Despite their diversity, the one thing that unifies them is a desire to improve the lives of animals in what academics sometimes call the real world. Now, universities value people who write about things. We value people who campaign and protest about things. But we also value people who improve things. And this is what our students aspire to do, and it's why Temple is such a wonderful role model for them and such an honored guest here tonight. Temple.
Well, I hope my slides are going to work tonight, and we don't have a commercial here for Microsoft. That's really, really good. I got a lot of things to talk about tonight, and then we're going to have time for questions. And I got to make sure I don't spill this water, because I think the separation of water and electronics is probably a really good idea, because I don't want to break the microphone for the radio station. All right. We'll be talking about how we maintain animal welfare standards. You know, today's younger consumer really cares about where their food comes from. But one big concern I have in a lot of these things is we have in a lot of younger people today, they've been brought up in a school system where they're not doing practical hands-on things. So there's a tendency to maybe sometimes get unrealistic about things. I've been advocating when I do talks at autism meetings on getting hands-on classes back in the schools because they teach practical problem solving. And my approach to animal welfare is to do things that are very, very practical. We've got to do things that actually make constructive change out in the real world. Now, a lot of students today are really separated from agriculture. There's a big farm outside of Chicago that's open to the public called Fair Oaks Farm. And it's really a good thing. Big dairy, big pig farm. And I asked them, what's the most common kind of weird question you get? And that question was, are those actually pigs? I am not kidding. Are they Disney animatronic pigs? No, they are real pigs. And this is kind of shocking. This is a survey that was done in the UK about 4 years ago that 50% of young people could not connect pigs with bacon, done by an organization called LEAF. There's also been a big survey that was published by the Center for Food Integrity that was presented at the American Society for Animal Science just this summer, 2015. And they found that with a lot of younger consumers, values were more important than what the science says. Done a lot of work with McDonald's and our Animal Welfare Committee with Joy Mensch, chicken expert, Janice Swanson, looking at the science, a great big study that was done that showed that the enriched cages that provide a nest box and provide perches for the hens. For large-scale commercials, probably a good way to go. But the new CEO decided to go with cage-free, even though the science showed there was more dirt in the air and dirty eggs. So I guess I better get all the designers together and we better figure out how to make it work. When it comes to cage-free chickens, I've seen really clean, good ones, and I've seen filthy ones. We've got to make things work out there in the world. When it comes to sow stalls, 2/3 of consumers don't like sow stalls. That's shown up in every scientific survey. I'm also very concerned in a lot of issues that people don't read deeply. I've been doing little informal surveys on the airplanes lately to see what people are reading. There's lots of paperback books. I was happy to see that yesterday. But there was only one newspaper on the plane, and that was mine. And the newspapers aren't doing very well online. I'm concerned about people not reading about news deeply enough, and it's not on the tech devices. Most of the tech devices have either got games, movies, or if it's a laptop, working material on it. Okay, another interesting thing. This is an old survey, but I think it's still very much true. Where the general public stands on a lot of issues is somewhere in between the activists. But what's happening now is social media is just magnifying extreme right and extreme left. There's an interesting paper that was recently published called Measuring Online Social Bubbles. In some ways, it's going to make the getting in silos worse because you're going to tend to talk with like-minded people. Now, there's a lot of good things about social media, but there's also some things that are not so good. Now, thing is, we need to be talking to the big mucky middle, but the big mucky middle gets bashed on both sides and says, okay, I'm going to go do something else. Okay, you look at what do consumers associate with factory farming? I can understand chickens, but not beef cattle ahead of pigs. That's kind of surprising. Another thing that shows up in lots and lots of consumer surveys is big is bad. What I have found is poorly managed is bad. You can have poorly managed big and well-managed big. You can have well-managed small and poorly managed small. It gets down to management. When I first started on improving animal welfare and improving cattle handling, starting back in the 70s, I thought I could do everything if I just got the right magic equipment. If I could just design the perfect system, everything's going to be just fine. And then I realized I had to train people. Then I had to train managers. But what really made the change is when I trained the McDonald's auditors back in 1999, and that forced people to manage things. And fixing the slaughterhouses actually wasn't that hard once I decided to fix them, because so many of the problems had to do with maintenance and with management rather than totally changing the systems. Here's large scale is bad. Another thing I've thought about large scale is fragile. We had an ice storm in 2007. It knocked out 4 miles of the great big power lines. Ice this big on the cables, bent the towers right over in half. That happened in eastern Canada. If another line of towers had been taken out, a couple of our big plants could have been down for a few months because those towers were completely wrecked. Big is fragile. And I think a lot of interest in local food comes from deep down inside. I think people get worried about food supply. Okay. You look at some survey data, it's starting to get a little old, but I think it's still true. Local is a thing that people really value. And I think it gets down to being concerned about food security. Okay, there are the five freedoms. Freedom from hunger and thirst, freedom from discomfort. We got to discussing when this discomfort becomes suffering. Now, I think in pictures, and this has helped me in my work with animals, because I don't think in abstractions. Discomfort. What's that word mean to me? A dreadful Continental Airlines flight that I took a good number of years ago. It was from the West Coast to Sydney. It was like a 16, 17-hour flight, packed 747, back when there was smoking. I was stuck in a middle seat, rock-hard middle seat, and Continental kept showing this horrible video of how they were going to get new, beautiful seats. And I had to watch that like 5 or 6 times during the whole flight. That's discomfort. Now, I wouldn't exactly call that suffering, but it definitely was discomfort. I think of that. You know, maybe you've got some animals kind of with some mud on them. Yeah, that's probably discomfort. Kind of pull their hair. You see, I'm visualizing what it'd be like if I was a steer and I had some mud stuck on me that was kind of dried out, pulled my hair. That would be discomfort. Freedom to express natural behavior. Now, today, I was talking a lot about basic things you got to do in animal welfare. And obviously, I got to feed them, I got to water them. But there's certain critical control points I need to do, like body condition. Okay, if I don't feed them enough, they're going to get too skinny. Or maybe they're sick and they get really skinny. Or lameness. There's been a lot of research right here on lameness. And in certain dairies, it's still very high. How could I have good animal welfare if 20 to 30% of the dairy cows are lame? There's certain things where no matter how good they are, now the things ought to fail. How about dirty, filthy animals? How about coat condition? Okay, they're organic, they got lice, they didn't treat it. That's not acceptable. How about sores and lesions like swollen hocks? How about air quality? I'm going to go in and the ammonia like takes your head off. That's absolutely not acceptable. Those things are critical control points where you better get a passing score or you're not going to have very good animal welfare. Okay, just because something's a standard practice doesn't necessarily make it right. And what Charlie Arnott found in his survey is that values kind of trump science. And that if a scientist was a mom, she was more credible than a scientist just a government scientist. You see, because that's shared values. Okay, auditing programs to maintain high standards. I did a lot of work with slaughter plants. So I put a lot of systems in. All through the 80s, early 90s, we put in a lot of equipment, put in the center track restrainer system. You can see that on beef plant video tour with Temple Grandin. But the problem is half my clients tore up equipment and wrecked it. They were not managing it until the McDonald's animal welfare audit started. And when a big customer started insisting on doing things right, I saw more change than I'd seen in my whole career. But I had a very simple, straightforward scoring system. Very, very simple. You manage things that you measure. And the trick is you got to figure out what are the things that I need to measure. Well, one no-brainer is how many cattle did you shoot dead and unconscious with one shot from the captive bolt stunner? Well, if you didn't get 95%, you failed the audit. Another measurement we found that worked really well was vocalization. Animals are mooing in a stunning area. You've got problems, such as too many electric prods, slamming doors on them, maybe too much pressure from a restraining device. We were measuring outcomes. We weren't telling them how to build something. But they had to achieve certain outcomes. And it was very, very simple, like traffic rules. In some dairies that have high levels of lameness, that's bad becoming normal. They get so used to looking at those lame dairy cows, they think that's normal. Now, there are some dairies that do a good job. Last year in Colorado, we went to three excellent dairies, big dairies. They had a 5% lameness score. And it had to do with management. First of all, have a big enough stall, keep the stalls clean, maintain the surface for the bedding, and you can have low lameness. Now, I have found in training stock people that if you train people, about 20% of people will stay good. They're kind of your natural stock people. Then you have a big bunch of people you got to supervise, and then you've got others that maybe shouldn't be there. But there's some people that just have a natural ability with animals. I went to a very interesting seminar at the Banff Pork Seminar in January, and there was an interesting presentation by a veterinarian from Nebraska. They talked about switching over to the way from gestation stalls. They were skeptical at first, but then they found they actually liked it. And you put 45 sows on a single electronic feeder, not 80. You don't want to be pushing things too hard. They also found they needed the right person to be their hog whisperer, teach young sows how to use the feeders. You've got to keep measuring things to prevent bad practices from coming back. Now, if you're writing guidelines, I want to ban these words. What's properly mean? What's adequate mean? What's sufficient mean? You can't have things that are vague. If you write vague guidelines, you're going to have different interpretations by different people. It's just like traffic rules. Here's something that's clear. All the pigs have to have a sufficient space to lie down without being on top of each other. That is clear. Now, this is the scoring system that worked very, very well for meatpacking plants that I developed for the American Meat Institute. It's now the North American Meat Institute. You can actually see this guideline on animalhandling.org or on my website, grandin.com. It's my last name. Percentage of animals stunned correctly on the first attempt. You just score it, yes, no. You got 99% for excellent, 95% for pass. You have to get all of them unconscious when you hang them up. That's how it's to be 100%. Electric prod, 5% for an excellent score. Again, we measure it. Poked with a prod, not poked with a prod. And some people might say, well, let's just ban electric prods. Well, if you've got a cow that absolutely decides it won't go in the stun box, what's better, one buzz with a prod or someone's cranking her tail so they've busted her tail? But I'm adamant about get it out of your hand. Now, we've managed to get rid of them, unloading trucks in the yards, totally get rid of them. How many animals vocalize and how many animals fall down during handling? These are outcomes. And then you have some acts of abuse that will be automatic failures, like dragging downers, deliberately slamming doors on animals, running animals over the top of other animals, or poking sensitive areas. Everything is on a per animal basis. Now, the trick is figuring out what are the right things to measure. I call these critical control points. And I've also discussed it in a lot of detail in my book, Improving Animal Welfare, a Practical Approach. I've discussed it in some of my popular books, Animals in Translation, Animals Make Us Human. You have to figure out which things to measure. There's a tendency on some scoring things to be measuring too much stuff. Bad stunning, it could be bad because of broken equipment or maybe lack of training. Many different things can make vocalization. Animals can slip and fall because the flooring is bad, or maybe they were handled roughly. Simple, easy to use. I'm an auditor trainer. The reality is I got to train an auditor in a day and a half workshop and then 3 shadow audits with somebody experienced. It's got to be simple, like traffic laws. There's a big difference between something that I'm going to use commercially and something I'm going to be using for research. Commercial things have got to be simple. Okay, then you get what's called inter-observer reliability. So if I audit the client, David does it, or Nina does it, we're going to get the same scores. It's like traffic rules. Speeding, things like that, you measure it. You measure it. Alcohol levels, it's measured. Okay, the principle is you measure a small number of critical control points that are outcomes of a multitude of different problems. It's a performance score. Don't tell them how to build a plan. Okay, it's similar to HACCP, Hazard Analysis Critical Control Points, used in food safety. It's also directly observable stuff. I'm worried about too many audits turning these giant paperwork things. So people have written up all these standard operating procedures, big binders full of standard operating procedures that nobody reads, all turning into paperwork. I want to look at directly observable things. That's what I want to look at. In 1996, I collected data for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and only 30% of the plants could stun 95% of the cattle unconscious with a single shot. You know what the number one cause of bad stunning was? Broken equipment. They had to fix the busted stuff. Now the plants have documented maintenance, they've got test stands, and we started measuring it, and they greatly, greatly improved. Right now, most of the plants are around 98 to 100% on an audit. You might wonder why I don't have more recent data. The lawyers found out I was getting the data and they stopped it. You know, the lawyers in there to mess up things. When we implemented this system in 1999, it was just us supply chain management people. Another thing that was very interesting is I took executives from McDonald's, Wendy's, and Burger King right around 97, 99 on their first trips to farms and slaughter plants. And when things were going good, it was fine. But when things were bad, it was like that show Undercover Boss. You've all seen that show. I saw those exact same kinds of reactions. Like, whoa, there's some stuff we gotta fix right here. Okay, things that we did to fix them. Out of 75 plants on the approved supplier list, only 3 had to build something expensive. Everything else we fixed with simple changes. Slaughter plants were easier than some of the stuff on the farms. Stunner maintenance, non-slip flooring, add a solid side so they didn't see people walking by. The other thing we did was changing lighting. Maybe put a light on an entrance so they don't see the dark. Always get asked, do animals know they're going to get slaughtered? I had to answer that question very early in my career. So I'd go to the slaughter plant, watch the cattle go up the chute, then I'd go out to the feed yard, watch the cattle go in the vaccinating chute. They behave the same way in both places. You look at the stress levels by measuring cortisol. It ranged from high to low. The range was the same in both the slaughter plant and the feed yards. And that was true back in 1997 when I did a paper called Assessment of Stress During Handling and Transport. And when I updated some of the things for the Proving Animal Welfare Practical Approach book, it's still the same. I put the new data in. The same range. Okay, animal comes up here and it sees people walking out of the maintenance shop. So I add some solid sides. Simple change. That's all I had to do. I would go into places with big pieces of cardboard and lights. It's amazing what you can do with lights and cardboard. You got to control what they're seeing. This shows a typical captive bolt. So that's a Jarvis pneumatic. There's a handheld captive bolt. And you can see in this picture that there's a little white curtain here made out of conveyor belting. The animal, well, that's really important that not get ripped off, because what that does is it prevents the next animal in line from seeing the motion. Details matter. Details matter. This is in my center track restrainer system. There's a video, which I'm not going to show tonight. You can look up Beef Plant Video Tour with Temple Grandin to see it. On this right here, we put a little piece of cardboard there so that, that the cattle wouldn't see people there. Now, this gun's heavy, and it's, you see that hook right there? That's attached to a cable that goes to spring-loaded balancer. So it doesn't weigh a ton for the guy. You got to maintain that. Details of procedure matter. You've got to keep your stuff fixed. Now, you might be wondering how that gun works, for those of you that are not familiar with it. Captive bolt's got a bolt about this long, bang, into the head, retracts. And when you use it correctly, it would have the same effect as a large caliber firearm. Here's an example of a light put on the chute entrance. Makes a big difference on how easy the cattle go in there. Or maybe I move a light. This particular plant had failed on two McDonald's audits because the pigs kept backing up. Had to hit them with the electric prodders. See the reflection there? I moved two lights over about this much. The reflection went away, and then they went up the chute. Sometimes things that simple would work. Okay, they know they're going to get slaughtered. We already talked about that. Now, there's some good things and some bad things, and I'll say to the students, what are some things that are good in this picture and bad? Well, they'll notice a piece of chain hanging down there. One thing that's good is I got white translucent panels in there, so you don't get the dark movie theater effect. If it's real sunny outside, they don't like going into the dark movie theater. But when I say, now, what are some things we might need to change in this picture? They often don't see that we got three people standing where they shouldn't be standing. Sometimes the most obvious is the least obvious, and people just don't see it. Now, I just want to show you places where I started. This is a feed yard back in the 70s. Here's the original Swift plant where I started. Got a little bit of the dark movie theater effect right there. And you'll also see this fence is not very high. That's Arizona Brahman cross cattle. They can go bloop and jump right over that, but they're not. The behavior was the same in both places. And this is showing the beef plant video tour. You can look that up yourself, see things that I have designed in that. I also have lots of stuff on my website, grandin.com. You can just download a beef plant video tour with Temple Grandin. Just type the title in, and you can find it. All right, how do we make sure, if you're running a supply chain, and I want to make sure I'm sourcing food or anything for that matter, and that my suppliers are doing what they're supposed to be doing? Say the clothing industry needs to get their act together. They've had factories fall down and crush people, factories burn up and burn people up, all kinds of bad things. And there are three legs on the tripod of supply chain management. This applies to all supply chain management for any product, for anything. You do internal audits using the measurement system. Then you have an independent third party go around and do the audits. But now I got to make sure that those people aren't in hotel rooms making it up somewhere or in their car just making it up. So the corporate people have to get out of the office and check up on enough places. And this is where when supply chains have broken down, especially some of the clothing stuff, these corporate audits weren't getting done. These guys weren't getting out of the office and seeing what was actually going on out in the field. Now, an auditor needs to be very observant. So I read a really ugly article about the iPhone, I think it was the iPhone 4 camera. It came from a factory not doing a very nice thing. And the auditor noticed, made a good observation, and they reported it. They walked by the office, the safe opened up, and they saw a whole pile of passports. And they were taking passports away from employees so they couldn't leave. And they reported that. That's being a really good auditor. You've got to report stuff, even stuff that's not in the audit document. But that's stuff that was really bad things. But where there's been food poisoning and other bad things, one of the legs wasn't there on the tripod. This applies to any program, any product. One of the things that we learned, interesting things we learned. The first year, there was no difference between announced and unannounced audits. People did bad things in front of us because they didn't know it was wrong. Second and third year, some employees had to be taken out. Fifth to tenth year, they really got clever at putting on shows. Tenth year, they got more clever at how to fake up the records. This is why I put the emphasis on things I can directly observe. Now, Cargill, some of the other companies, have now put in video auditing. Well, this solves the problem of people acting good when they're being watched. That has been really, really good, and they use the simple scoring system. Okay, video auditing. A lot of bad handling going on. Stunning tended to stay good because it was so dependent on maintenance. But handling, when the back was turned, the electric plotters came out. And video auditing is only going to work if it's monitored by people outside the plant. Yeah, the internal audits need to be done on the video, but if you don't have outside auditors, the novelty wears off. It's got to be on a real, rigid program, outside people doing it. Guess what? No more yelling and whistling. Let's just talk about a few things in cattle handling. Calm animal is easier to handle. Get the distractions out of your handling facility. Non-slip flooring. I cannot emphasize how important that is. We had to do a lot of non-slip flooring to get plants into compliance, especially in the unloading area, stun box floors. These animals will just stand there and they'll go like this and get crazy because they're slipping like this. You got to fix that. Okay, let's just look at how we set up standards. We got to go outside the plant now. Our plants have been getting really good, and when I see a welfare problem at a slaughter plant now, it's something I have to fix at the farm. Like, there's still some dairies bringing in half-dead emaciated dairy cows or beef cattle that are lame. We're starting to get a lameness in beef cattle now. Or we've got really wild cattle. See, a man on a horse and a man on the ground are two totally different things. And I've seen cattle that were very super tame to the man on the horse. They meet the first man on foot, they're bouncing off the walls because they've never seen that before. Animal's a visual thinker. You want to understand animal behavior. You've got to get away from words. It's sensory-based. What are they seeing, hearing, smelling? They remember things. They remember bad experiences. I have a paper you might want to look at called How Farm Animals React and Perceive Stressful Situations Such as Handling, Restraint, and Transport. And a lot of it has to do with previous experiences. And it's really important when you introduce an animal to something new. Could be introducing a puppy to the vet. That first experiences are good first experience. Super important. So the first thing I want to do is what I call an animal-based outcome measure. And the scoring system I showed for the meat plants is an outcome-based system. And then we have some practices you might ban. Okay, for example, you might not allow tail docking dairy cows. Some stuff you're not allowed to do. And get away from the input-based things. Except for a few. You need a few for things like space requirements on trucks. There's a few things like that. So what are things that I need to do in a very basic animal welfare? And I've got to look at body condition. Really skinny dairy cows. Really skinny sows that are all bony bumps. Lameness. That's been a lot of work being done on lameness. If I've got 40% lame dairy cows, there's no way I could have good welfare. Filthy, dirty animals. They're laying in muck this deep. I don't care what your animal is. It could be chickens. I've seen chickens that came out and looked like they had roofing tar put on them. Yeah, somebody needs to fail an audit over that. Injuries. You're going to have to make the scorecards for each kind of animal. Coat condition in organic. You better treat the lice and the bald spots and things like that. I get concerned, especially in U.S. organic standards, of sick animals not getting treated. Air quality, indoor facilities, then we can look for abnormal behaviors. But I got to fix these critical control points. There are certain things that if they're this deep in liquid slop, somebody needs to fail an audit, no matter how good everything else is. There's certain just absolutely critical things. Good dairies are at 5% lameness. Okay, now lameness is a really good example of an outcome-based measure. Look at all the different things here that can cause lameness. Housing, that would not be stalls too small, rapid growth in chickens, leg conformation, that's been a very bad issue in the late 80s in pigs, and I'm seeing some leg conformation issues in beef cattle now, foot care issues, foot diseases, injuries, or just pushing an animal too hard, what I call biological system overload. You've got a laying hen now, and when she gets to the end of lay, they get broken keel bones really easily. That's the big bone right here, because they got osteoporosis. That's just pushing the biology to the point where the animal has problems. And I have another paper you might want to look at. It's free online. It is animal welfare and society concerns finding the missing link. All right, then we still have got to look at some things like death losses during transport, on-farm death losses. Now, when I go visit on an audit, these things require records. So I tend to put more emphasis on the things I can directly observe. I've been around for a long time. I've seen too many falsified records. Okay, then you have some practices you don't allow. Okay, phasing out gestation stalls. The really small chicken cages. Yeah, they say, okay, there's some practices we don't do. Okay, housing for sows. Yep, you're ahead of us on that, just in case some people aren't familiar with what these things look like. You've got two issues, whether or not you have the sow stall. That one actually fits in it. This one here doesn't even fit in it. She's so jammed in. That's going to just be totally abusive. But there's actually some work that was done years ago by Andrew Fraser, I think he's retired now, that giving the pigs some roughage to eat was really important on preventing. Oh, it was your study? That was your study. I'm sorry, David. Sorry about that. That was your study on giving the little bits of straw. Oh, I'm sorry, and I'm just letting Andrew get credit for that. Sorry about that, David. I'm really sorry. Okay. Now, there's an example of barb biting, for those that don't know what that behavior looks like. What do pigs need? Things to chew up and destruct. I did some research back in the 80s for my PhD, and I gave pigs a choice. What kind of things would they rather have to play with? Something soft they can chew up, like a rubber hose or a piece of cloth, or hard chain. They will choose the soft thing that they can destruct. Okay, and that just shows the Dot's dairy cow. That's it's a regular battery cage. Now, when I first saw this, they took me and just showed me the young chickens. And then you got the old mops, where when they get to the end of lay, all the feathers are gone. That picture came from HSUS, but I saw some just as bad. And there's genetic issues here. These hens were crazy. They beat the feathers off. See, the problem is, hen was bred to put everything she's got into her eggs, and there's nothing left of the hen. Actually, the cages didn't cause that. Also, they jammed them in there so tight that when they lay down at night, they were on top of each other. And I remember when I went on a McDonald's trip, this is a good long time ago, and I saw the old ladies like this. They didn't want to show them to me. And we got back to the office, and I said, if I got 10 people from the Chicago airport and I showed them this, what do you think they're going to think? And the guy who ran the chicken house goes, the health is really good. That's an example of bad becoming normal. Okay. Now people are getting rid of stalls. Okay, that's typical group housing system. There's a lot of discussion. Which group housing system do you use? I'm going to say let the industry innovate. There's electronic sow feeders, and please don't put 80 pigs on one feeder. That's overloading your system, and you've got to find the right person to train the young pigs. Really important. This is free access stalls. It's like sow stalls where they can go in and out. These work really nice, but they're extremely expensive. Now, I go back to this system right here. What I learned at the Banff Pork Seminar this January is that I can build this system for the same price for building sow stalls, and the production will be the same. You got to get the right people to run it. You've also got to use the right genetics. There are some lines of pigs that are very nasty about fighting. Okay, which system is best? Let's let people innovate. There's a bedded system. Okay, if you're using a bedded system, your number one problem you can get with this is people don't use enough bedding. And if you don't use enough bedding, you will have a sea of slop in there. I won't use the bad word for manure, but a big sea of slop. You got to use a lot of bedding to make this work. There's an aviary system. Chickens have got litter there. They kick up the dust. You got to figure out a way to solve that problem. Since the food companies and the customers out there want to go to this system, we got to make it work. Now I'm going to have to get into engineering mode to solve the problems of dirty eggs and dirty air. I think it's going to get solved. And this is the colony cage, which from a scientific standpoint gives the hens things she wants, a perch. Hens want a secluded place to lay their eggs. When they lived in the wild, they go under the bushes to hide and lay their eggs. And at night, they like to perch up high. That's just their natural behavior. And there's a few baseline minimum standards for a few things we're going to need. Now, a lot of people ask me, how can you justify eating meat? Done a lot of thinking about that. I've got one of the kinds of genetics where I don't work very well on a vegan diet. I tried it. Doesn't work. But I can solve the welfare issues. Slaughterhouse actually was the easiest part of it to fix. But how about the sustainability issues? And I've been going to some crop seminars. And last year at our International Cattle Symposium, our department, and this is, I'm really glad they did this, invited a crop scientist to come and explain the origin of the best soils for raising crops. And I learned last year, just a year ago, that the Mahle soils, Iowa and Illinois, the very best soils we have, were created by herds of grazing bison. The grazing animals are part of the ecosystem. Yes, they put out some methane, but when they're used right in crop rotation, I was up at the University of Guelph. They had a cattle meeting there where I gave a talk in, and they had crop meetings. Guess what? I decided to go do the crops. Really glad I did. And I learned about crop rotation, rotating crops. Foraged crops are part of rotation. Putting grazing animals on the field is part of rotation. They're part of the ecosystem. Also, there's vast amounts of land in the world where the only way we can raise food on it is grazing animals. You can't crop it. I had a chance to go to the Australian outback this November, flew into Darwin, Australia, get on a small plane, 2.5 hours into nothing. Big, gigantic 800-square-mile cattle station with Grey Brahman cattle on it. You can't crop this land. The wells would run dry, but you can raise grazing animals on it. You don't really understand the vastness until you see it. The plane doesn't have enough fuel for the round trip. We had to stop at the airplane self-serve, put your Visa card in, airplane gas station on the way back. A plane is your car. You're off the grid 350 miles from the nearest grocery store, completely off the grid. That was a bit of a mind blower. And that's my website, grandin.com. And we're going to have plenty of time right now to do a lot of questions, because this is the part that I really like to do. But just to finish up, when I first started in the 70s, I thought I could fix everything with equipment. Then I realized I had to train employees. Then I started training managers. And then in 1999, I started training customers. And that's when I saw the biggest amount of change. Because on the slaughter plants, people had to manage equipment they already had right for the most part. And there were three plants that did have to rebuild, but the other ones didn't. Farming, there's some systems I'm going to need to get changed. But the big customers, the people who buy, drive change. Now, we've got to make sure that we do changes that work. That's the important thing. We don't get pushed into something that's not going to work. Okay, let's open it up for questions. But if nobody has a question, I'm going to pick somebody. Because I like to do questions.
Have them raise their hand.
So we've got two microphones. Amanda has one and the other there. So please just wait for a microphone so everyone can hear the question.
Okay. Then the radio can hear it too.
Try again.
Okay.
It's working
now.
I would love it if you would share with us the moment that you realized this was your calling.
Well, the moment I realized why I got involved in livestock, I was exposed to cattle when I was in high school. When I was 14, and I lived back east, my mother got remarried, and it was my stepfather's sister had a ranch. And I went and visited the ranch when I was 15. Kids get interested in things they get observed, exposed to. Hadn't been exposed to beef cattle, wouldn't have gotten interested. It was going out there to the ranch. You know, we've got to get kids out careers. I tell every student that I work with, try on different careers. Find out what you like, find out what you hate. Get out and try a lot of stuff. Do a lot of career-relevant internships. I will say that to every single student there is.
Hi. I was just wondering who's funding these audits, and then as well, how are governments getting involved in standardizing
the U.S., it's all done commercially. U.S. politics, I don't want to discuss that. No, this was all done commercially. Big customers. McDonald's started it. Wendy's came in 6 months later with a great, fantastic program. I trained them. Then Burger King came in. Other thing that made the scoring system work, and I can go back and put that, maybe I can't go back and put that up there. Made the scoring system work. It's very simple, very straightforward. And I made sure Wendy's, Burger King, and McDonald's all did the same thing. It's going to be a gigantic mess for the industry if everybody's doing something different. Now, you're going to have different niche markets. But I think basic animal welfare, there's certain basic things, like the five things to score there for the meatpacking plant, the list of basic things for all kinds of animals. I can't have animal welfare if they're deep in muck or they're covered with sores or their hair's falling out or some other problem or their feathers are all gone and it's not due to molting. You've got to deal with those basics first. Another big concern I have on a lot of policy issues is we're getting a lot of people now coming involved with these getting involved with these policies that have no practical experience at all. It's all getting very theoretical. When I first started, people in activist groups did something hands-on. Maybe they worked in an animal shelter. Now you're getting people that have law degrees and things like this, and they have no contact with the field to find out exactly what's happening on the ground. And you might get some things that you do that make things worse. Just like the people in the corporations got to get out and find out what's going on. United Airlines is a really good example. There's a great article in Business Week. It's United's quest to be less awful. And they were truly awful. Oh, they book not enough time in the schedule. The flight crew delays all the time because they book all the flight crews too tight. It was just terrible. New CEO comes in. What's the first thing he did? He got out of the office. And he learned very quickly that hiring the cheapest, crappy ground operations contractor was a really bad idea, and they were horribly understaffed. He canceled some flights, put more time in the schedule. On the latest flight I came in, they actually had time to de-ice and be on time. All he had to get out of the office and see that. People are a whole lot nicer. I've seen a definite improvement. And it happened when the boss got out of the office to find out what's going on. Yep, and I've noticed a noticeable improvement. Okay?
Hi,
right there,
my name
you
is
had a
Sandra,
question?
Yeah. And I...
Oh. Maybe we have to get the mic so the radio can hear it.
So, Temple, thank you for the great talk. I just wanted to get your comment on your thoughts on motivating behavior. From the farmer's perspective.
So perspective?
So how do farmers, all these things are coming down.
Well, what I'm finding, the lameness, there's a point where it gets to be have to. Hate to say that.
Yeah.
I found when I start out, okay, I put a nice system in to a plant, a ranch, or a feed yard. About 20% of my clients did a good job. I didn't have to do anything. I just showed them how to do it right, and they did it. But there's others where it's going to have to be a have to. And out of the 75 McDonald's suppliers, 3 plant managers had to be removed.
Yeah, because
anything changed.
I can be in Brazil and give a talk on animal welfare and have 1,000 farmers in the room,
yep.
Highly motivated to know what to do, what is the right thing to do. And you and I both know that there's a lot of talks that we give in North America, and it's much more of a struggle.
You know what's happening is I have found countries that export.
Yeah.
And in 1978, I had a chance to go to Scandinavia, I went to England, I went to Australia. And the Scandinavian and the Australians and New Zealands, where they export, even back in the bad old days, are really good. Now, in the U.S. and Canada, things are pretty... Canada was somewhat better than the U.S., but North America was pretty bad in the 80s and the 90s. They don't export. They're exporting now, but they didn't back then. You export, you've got customers constantly inspecting you. Brazil wants to be an export market. That's part of the motivation. And it gets into have to. And when the McDonald's audit started, the other thing I did to make it work was I tried to fix whatever older, not very nice facility they had, make it work. I was amazed at some of the older facilities we made work with non-slip flooring, changing lighting, training, moving small groups of animals, put a solid side up in just the right place. But in the dairy industry right now, we have about a third of our dairies that are doing a fabulous job, 5% lameness. We have another third of the dairies that do an awful job, and they're not going to change until they have to. Hate to say it. I know that's not very nice. And Helen Ray, you know, has done the work on making change. Some people, you get them to start measuring it, they start doing it. But I wrote the original guideline with the five things you measure, and that came out in 97. Only one plant used it. And McDonald's started using it in 99, and it took off. Big customer. Had the power of the Golden Arches behind me, but we used that power wisely. It was a gigantic tipping point, and they had to do it. And the other thing is I bent over backwards to do reverse conflict of interest, because I had a conflict of interest on equipment, and not be shoving expensive facilities down their throat. I'm very proud of the fact that out of 75 plants, only three had to build something expensive. Yeah, my stuff was involved with two of those, and the pig one it wasn't.
Did you do animal welfare research in Canada and in Europe too? And what were the biggest differences?
I did some audits of animal welfare in Canada. See, some of that was in the 80s, and at that time Canada was ahead of the U.S. Then the McDonald's audits took off down in the U.S., and things in the U.S., actually right now when it comes to slaughter plants, is really, really good. Europeans have a lot of rules, but I've seen some stuff that hasn't been that good. You know, straw-bedded animals in muck. They didn't put enough straw in there. I've seen that. Now, our plants have really gotten good, and the thing that frustrates me is nobody knows about it, and they're really good. And that's why we did the beef plant video tour, the pork plant video tour, and the industry got really worried about that. And you might wonder in those videos why my books are all over the front of it. That's because a focus group... Half the people in the focus group didn't know who I was, and it was important to explain who I was on that. We made that first video in December, but they were scared to put it up. Then there was another undercover, really nasty video, and some of these undercover videos have motivated some change. Some of the dairy stuff's nasty. Pitchfork in the dairy parlor, that's like horrid. Really, really horrid. There was a big uproar going on about the latest nasty video featuring dairy cattle. And at a meatpacking plant, and I called up my friend Janet Riley. She and I had worked on the video together. And I said, Steve Jobs never asked permission to do anything. You got a new name. You're Janet Jobs. And you know what you're doing this weekend? You're going to post this weekend. Are you going to ask permission? Of course not. This is what I learned in construction. If you need to block the road with a concrete truck, you do it fast, and if the police come around, you ask for their help to direct the traffic. And Janet posted, and the pork people came and wanted to do theirs, and then the turkey people are doing theirs, and we're working right now on finishing up a sheep one. Okay?
So I'm just wondering, you kind of talked about organic versus the other industry. Do you find better compliance, or is there a difference? Or do you have special...
Well, organic, there's some differences between U.S., Canadian, and European organic standards. And one thing I get worried about at home, we seem to be really into food contaminants. So if you can't use any antibiotics at all, where European standards, no mass medication, no growth promotants, but you are allowed to treat a sick animal with twice the drug withdrawal time. Where in the U.S., if I treat an individual sick animal, I have to take it out of the program. Now, if I got a big farm where I have both organic and conventional, I just switch it over to conventional. But let's say I have a small farm, let's say maybe 20 cattle, something like that, and I got to take one of my steers and dump it off at the sale barn because it won't be organic anymore. There's a temptation not to treat. Even though the standard requires treatment, I've seen too many coughing cattle and stuff like that. I've got serious concerns about not treating sick animals. Now, if we do really good management, use hardy genetics, then we won't have many sick animals. But treating sick animals, sick animals that need antibiotics not getting treated is bad. That concerns me, and I've seen way too much nasty lice where it's gotten to be bad becoming normal, bald spots all over them. There are genetic differences in having lice. That's why I've got coat condition in there as one of the things I want to look at, because I've seen too many, I've seen some very nasty lice where it got so bad where the cattle rubbed their hair off and it got red and they were bending in half trying to lick it and they couldn't reach it, and that's horrid. That's not okay. And chickens, you do feather condition. The Laywell website has some very nice tools for scoring feather condition. Okay. We got to get the mic. Okay, David's got a mic right here.
Dr. Granit, I'm so happy to hear you speaking out about the sow crates, but could you speak a little bit about farrowing crates? Because I was disappointed to learn that a humane animal standard certification body that we were looking at getting certified by still allows farrowing crates. So I'm wondering
I think farrowing crates are a little more defensible because they protect the pigs from getting smashed. I've been reading some of the stuff from Denmark, and there's a stall where you can open it up like this, the sow can turn around. Now, when the piggies are really small, you can close it up. When she's nest building, you can open it up. Then when she's having the little tiny fragile piglets, close her in 3 days, little tiny fragile piglets, and then open it back up. And these are very economical. And the thing that's interesting is it's not a new idea. When I was revising Improving Animal Welfare, a Practical Approach, second edition, I found an ancient old patent showing this design made in wood, an old patent. Yeah, sometimes there's some good things to get reinvented. But that's a sensible thing to do, because let's say I want to, I got to wean the pigs off, and I've got a mean sow, I'm afraid she might bite me, I can close her in. Open, and then I can only keep her closed in, let her do her nest building where she's loose. Then when she starts to have them, close her in. I think that makes that kind of system makes sense. You do need something to protect the pigs. The other thing is I don't think we can put every pig outside. In eastern Colorado, for many years, we had a gigantic outdoor pig operation, outdoor farrowing sows. They were doing fabulous until we had one of our horrendous big storms where we had 25-foot drifts across the highway. That was the end of the pigs. I just found that out recently. I often wondered what happened to them. I just found out about a week ago that they were killed in that storm. You see, most of the winters, it's open. It's okay. But about every 10 years or so, we get a doozy, and they come in, and we had a big storm up in the Dakotas that wiped out a lot of ranch cattle. People forget nature can be harsh. People forget about that. It wasn't time to get the pigs in. The storm was way worse than they thought it was going to be. There was still, they had to get huge machines to get the freeway plowed out. And 2 weeks later, you still had where they'd like slice through these mountains of snow. You had snow like this high, as high as the ceiling, or they'd slice through on the freeway even 2 weeks later. It was just, and I've lived in Colorado for 26 years. It was the single worst storm we ever had. Doesn't happen very often, but that was the end of the pigs, and they went out of business.
Hi. I had a question regarding influencing consumers and potentially pushing for change in regulatory on organics, organic husbandry. As meat eaters, we make our choices primarily on animal husbandry. That's the number one thing. Or welfare, and we've even bought products at one vendor where they've told us we don't buy the organic pork product anymore because we went to the farm and they weren't treating them as well as.
Well, this gets into supply chain management. Right. You've got to make sure whatever your claim is, you better make sure you're actually doing it. And I've been involved with a lot of people in trying to help set up supply chain management systems. And you got to have, where they had the clothing factories that fell down and things, they had farmed it all out to third party, but the corporate people didn't get out and fly to some of these faraway places where the factories were in Bangladesh and find out what was going on there. top management and these companies have got to get their butt out of the office and find out what's going on. You can't just farm it out to a third-party auditing company. Now, the third-party auditing company is a really important leg on the tripod because you've got to avoid the fox guarding the hen house type of things. But you still have to have that leg where the corporate people get out there to make sure the third-party auditing company is doing their job. You did whatever standard you got to make sure people are actually doing it.
Hi, thank you so much for your talk. I was just wondering, as a consumer, what are the top two things you would say we could do to try to affect that sort of change you had noticed? You said you'd made some changes.
Well, I'm not going to talk in such generalities. Down in the States, our federally inspected slaughter plants, they've gotten really good. USDA's gotten super strict. They're about as good as they're going to get. I've got things I got to, you know, fix. Right now, some of the biggest messes we got right now is in dairy. There seems to be a certain segment of the dairy industry that isn't going to change until they're forced to change. You know, some of the pig people, I've seen to be more willing to change. And the thing that's interesting, in the U.S., Smithfield was the first to say they're going to start phasing out sow stalls voluntarily. Why Smithfield? I think it has to do with where the corporate office is located. If you look at a map of the U.S., their corporate office is right near the population centers. The kids of the executives are going to be in those population centers. Okay, I was in Nebraska last week. I had a great time there because Nebraska is where I implemented the McDonald's audits. It's in my old stomping ground. I had to commune with the vacant lot where one of our favorite hotels got torn down. Because that's sort of going back and, you know, homecoming. But I talked to one farmer there, and he said, are they really going to make us give up sow stalls? Then I've been asking a question to sort of learn how much contact they have with the population centers. Okay, I asked some people in Nebraska, how many of you have a Facebook friend in either Chicago or some big city? Like two hands went up in a room of like 100 people. When I went to the farm meeting up there outside of Guelph, 20% of the hands had somebody in a big city. You see, I think in our heartland in the U.S., they're so kind of inside the box, they don't communicate with anybody in the population centers. But I've now done this test in several places right in that heartland area. It sort of doesn't dawn on them where, you know, just look where Smithfield, Virginia, that's right by the near the population centers. I think that had something to do with why they did it first. Okay?
Yes. Are there guidelines for transporting animals and livestock trucks for duration of the trip?
Well, the U.S. basically just has got the ancient old railroad 28-hour law. The guidelines are all being made by industry. And, you know, now they're requiring to take port quality assurance. It's going to be all driven by the big buyers because regulations, that's not the way to go in the U.S. But the ironic thing is there was a time where U.S. slaughter plants were better than Canada. See, it used to be Canada was better. Now, we still have got our problem areas. And I got asked this morning, how about economics and welfare. There are situations where welfare can be improved with economics and situations where welfare is going to get worse. And the very first research project I ever did, and this is still true, was I looked at bruises on feedlot cattle. And when they were sold live weight, where the slaughterhouse had to pay for the bruises, they had twice as many bruises as cattle sold in the carcass, where the feed yard had to pay for bruises. In other words, holding people accountable for damage was a motivator. But if you have a situation where losses can be passed on to the next segment, right now we still have, and I think you've got some problems with this here too, beef cattle getting weaned on the truck and going on to a feed yard with no vaccinations. We know that's a dreadful practice. But if I'm a rancher and cattle prices are really high, why should I go to all the work and expense of vaccinating my cattle 45 days before shipment if I'm not going to get paid any extra money for doing it? That's an economic incentive that goes the wrong way. So economic incentives can work both ways, either for or against animal welfare.
I'm wondering if you could tell me if you've done any work with the equine slaughter.
Well, I've been to slaughter plants up here for horses, and they can work just fine. What's happened with that, there's certain issues in the states that have gotten so hot that I don't really want to, just jump in a fire. I want to go do things where I can make a difference. Now, I've seen horse slaughter done in a really low-stress, good way. And these are the things you got to have. A non-slip floor in the box. Have to have that. High enough side so the horse doesn't look out onto the slaughter floor. And two people. This is very important. One person to load the horse into the box, and the other person shoots. Cattle, you can do it with one. But with a horse, by the time you've run around the other side and picked up the gun, the horse is going crazy. What you want is walk in, shut the door, bang. That's what you want. And if you have that, and management's got to care. So that's the four things. You don't have to have a real fancy facility. And you can do horse slaughter really well. And I've seen it done. And then the plant where I saw it done well got caught on video whipping a horse in the face. And they probably did not have the two people. They were probably understaffed. It's back to management.
We have our last two questions.
Okay.
Hi, I was wondering, as a consumer, is there any way of knowing or any certification system to know if brands and businesses are engaging in these auditing systems?
Well, on the big federally inspected slaughter plants, they're so heavily audited now that in the U.S., if you buy from a federally inspected plant, there's probably a pretty low probability that something bad's happening there. When I see problems now and I go to those plants, it's something I have to fix at the farm. And one of the worst things I still have to fix at the farm is half-dead dairy cows. There's still a segment of the industry bringing those in. And there's some lameness issues starting to show up in beef cattle we didn't have before. Super wild cattle that have never been handled on foot are dangerous and really bad to handle. But the half-dead dairy cows, that's big number one. That's got to stop. And there's still a segment of the dairy industry bringing those in. And then there's another very good segment of the dairy industry that doesn't do this stuff, that does a superb job. And I went to some of those dairies in 2015.
I'm curious, how do you communicate to consumers? How do you get them to change?
What do you mean, how do I get them to change?
How do you make them understand the technical?
Well, one of the things, a lot of consumers have responded to some of the hideous videos that have appeared online. And I get asked, if I was hired by a big corporation to implement their animal welfare program, what's the first thing I'm going to do? The first thing I got to do is make sure there's no acts of abuse, like a pitchfork in the milking parlor, beating pigs up with a gate rod, just out and out, out animal abuse, something that makes a hideous video when it shows online. You can't get away from the iPhone. That's the new enforcer. So that's my first step. And my second step is going to be the things I showed, like the body condition scoring, lameness scoring, injuries and lesion scoring, dirtiness, air quality. I'm going to do handling scoring, electric prod use, falling down, hitting things. I can do handling scoring. Handling's improved. My student, Ruth Woliwode, did a survey of 28 feed yards about 2 years ago on handling. Really good scores. You can look it up online. If you can spell Woliwode, it's spelled W-O-I-W-O-D-E, Ruth Woliwode. And it's also on the Google Scholar. You can find it, a chart that's got the handling data. It's good. Handling is the bright spot. Handling's improved, especially in big feed yards. That's one thing. It has improved. And there's a lot of people now doing low-stress handling courses that we didn't have before. It's getting better. Frustrates me is some of the good things the industry's done, like getting slaughterhouses cleaned up, that they don't know about. And when they get a bad video now at some little hole-in-the-wall state-inspected plant, some of those are still bad. Or it's a foreign video, and I can tell it's foreign by the type of cattle that are there, the electric wiring, there's things like that I can tell if it's foreign. Okay, one more quickie, and then we'll wrap it up, and I'll hang around and talk to people for as long as they want to talk. And if nobody has any other questions, I just want to thank everybody for coming.
say a second. I just have to tell you about Temple's day today. This morning before breakfast, I gave her the proofs of a short book that she'd written on autism. They needed the corrections. She did that before breakfast and phoned in the changes. We had breakfast. Someone brought her here. She did her first class on applied animal behavior. Then there was a roundtable discussion about auditing. Then she did a second class in our animal welfare course. Short break, not much of a break, and a third class, this one in our animals and society course. Then she was walked over to the Buchanan building because the psychology class there, 180 students on autism, just pleaded, could she possibly come and meet with them? So she did that and then raced over here to do this. Now, Temple and I were born about 10 weeks apart. We are essentially the same age, and just reading what she does makes me tired. So on behalf of all of us, it would only be humane to let her go down to the reception. So Temple, for your passion, your accomplishments, and 40 years of experience that no one in the world has got, we thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Flayed, spray, spray my faucet corn, my blister horn flung into the day. Why oughta storm my gristle formed dung into the shirt doused bed where socks loom my fizzled norm sung inside the dirt hole.
This is John M. Bennett, and you are listening to CITR FM 101.9 in Vancouver. British Columbia,
mocks the
Canada.
Room, my ray, my osteo floor, my glistened shorn mug flayed.
Tune into Post Rock Friday from 10 to 11 with your host John P. for the best in post rock, drone, ambient, experimental, and noise.
Hey, it's Prophecy Sun. When I'm not riding my bike, hanging out with my cats, or making soup, I'm listening to Tweets and Tunes on CITR Radio 101.9 FM in Vancouver.